And here we are back with Avital Rybaczynski, who is the Meyerson Professor of Urbanism at the University of Pennsylvania and one of our leading thinkers about the urban world. And it's really a pleasure to have you on the air with us, Avital. Welcome.
Thank you.
So just a very specific question about our cities first. I mean, your latest book that I've been going through, and you write a lot about Lewis Mumford and Jane Jacobs as two of the great thinkers about the urban world that you used to love as a young man, then realized their thoughts were almost contradictory.
Yes. Well, Mumford, of course, was much older than Jane Jacobs, but they found themselves on sort of opposing sides because Jacobs was very skeptical of planning and particularly skeptical of the Garden City movement. And Mumford, on the other hand, was a great proponent of planning, had known people and really everybody in the movement in America. Patrick Geddes, who was sort of grand old man who virtually invented city planning. And so they were really had very different takes on the American city and where it should go. And she sort of opened fire on him because she's in the death and life of great American cities. She was very critical, both of Mumford and of the movement that he very much espoused. And then he later wrote a very cutting critique in the New Yorker, where he wrote a column for a very long time. And so I didn't know all that when I was a student up in Montreal. So for me, they were just sort of the two big names in terms of writing about cities.
But what's interesting to me when I was reading that and reading your thoughts on that is that people like Mumford and Jacobson, any kind of contradictory great thinkers that we can think of that wrestle with these issues that we face, the contradictions don't necessarily mean that they're both wrong. They may both feed into a truth in a different way, it seems to me.
They were, and they were looking at it, of course, at different times. Jane Jacobs, her real critique, I think, was of the urban renewal that was taking place in American cities, and that was what kind of set her off in writing this book. And she saw the Garden City movement and the various sort of professional planning ideas as having led to urban renewal, whereas Mumford, of course, was also critical of urban renewal, but from a different sort of vantage point. Interesting thing about cities is that it's one of those topics or subjects that it's not a science; it's not something you can study. I mean, Jane Jacobs was self-taught. She was a journalist. Mumford was also not an academic. He was really an essayist and a journalist. And often the most interesting writing about our cities has come from sort of these unexpected directions, because it isn't, despite what city planners sometimes say, it isn't really a science where people really have sort of black and white answers for everything. And often when we do have black and white answers is when we get into trouble, which is what happened in the 60s, where we thought we knew how to replan cities with urban expressways and public housing projects and sort of mega block projects, super block projects, and it really created a great deal of problems in subsequent years, where many cities are still sort of recovering from that urban renewal period.
As this city that we're broadcasting from is one of those cities that suffered mightily from urban renewal and development and city housing projects and gigantic highways that divided the city that ended up going nowhere. I mean, it devastated the city in many ways. It's still trying to, I mean, like many other cities, trying to recover from that period.
Well, something that Americans tend to forget is we're a very big country, much bigger than most countries, and highly urbanized, so we actually have hundreds of cities. And, you know, we're not like France and England that have one major city, and then everything else is sort of two steps down the ladder. We have many important cities. We're decentralized, so the financial center and the government center and the entertainment center are all over the country. But what it means is that these cities compete with each other, And so when an idea comes along like urban expressways, it sort of spreads because cities don't want to feel that they're falling behind. And so the idea gets taken up usually by a big city like L.A. or New York. But then smaller cities kind of just, they figure, well, they know what they're doing and we have to keep up with them. So we have to do the same thing. And whether it's pedestrian malls in cities, which was a terrible idea, but there were hundreds of them in the country, literally, in the 60s and 70s, or whether it's, waterside entertainment districts, or mm-hmm. these ideas kind of spread across the whole country, and cities copy each other, not particularly because they don't have any imagination, but really because they're in competition. You know, Paris is not in competition with any other French city. Maybe it's in competition with England, mm-hmm. but with London. But Paris, London, Madrid, I mean, they are the center of their countries, and they have been for centuries. Whereas our cities, you know, Boston was one of the five biggest cities in the country 100 years ago, and today I think it's number 25. It's still a nice city, but it's no longer a large city compared to other ones. And then there are cities like Detroit, which have lost population and which are not just smaller, but they're economically considerably worse off than they were in the 20s when Detroit was one of the great sort of powerhouse cities in the country. So it's not just that there are many cities and they're competing, but it's a kind of ruthless system where you can get bumped off the train very easily.
So where has that led you in terms of your thinking about how cities should begin to think of themselves, or as you often do, in metropolitan areas beyond just a city? We have to think differently as individual places.
Well, of course, the metropolitan area has complicated everything, because at least when we had cities with city limits, and I'm thinking now about 100 years ago, there was a huge difference between what a city was and what living outside the city meant. And there were sort of cultural and attitudes, and everything was different if you lived in the country. Whereas today, everybody lives an urban lifestyle. Mm-hmm. Whether they live in a farm or the suburb or the city, the way of life is not enormously different. They see the same movies, they read the same books, they watch the same television. So the differences are no longer as big. And of course, the metropolitan areas, which is where the majority of people now live, no longer in the city, are not defined in the way that cities are. So the city of Baltimore or a Philadelphia has a kind of, you know, definition. People traditionally had slightly different ways of speaking. They had their own newspaper. They had often slightly different foods, and there was a kind of identity. Whereas, you know, a metropolitan area is just too big to identify with. So it's a kind of slippery concept, but it is the way we live today. So it makes it very difficult, I think, to take the lessons of cities, which after all are thousands of years old, to apply them to the new problems, because the new problems truly are unprecedented. I mean, it's an overworked expression, but in this case it applies, because cities are thousands of years old, mm-hmm. but metropolitan areas and an urban culture, a culture that's entirely urban, is something very new. We've never had that before.
So you're saying in many ways we've become an American, an urbanized culture without, maybe I'm being, I don't put a value judgment on this, but without the value and advantage of being really a city.
We're an urban culture, that's right, that doesn't live in cities exclusively.
Right.
And also that lives, the fastest growing segment of cities, and the large number of people still live in cities, and the urban population isn't shrinking by any means. But what's happening is that the little cities are growing much more important. And so more people live in small cities today than they did 20 years ago. The cities that are really growing quickly are very small compared to the biggest cities. Again, it's hard to, one needs a kind of historical perspective, because cities like Florence in the Renaissance were probably 75,000 people. So, you know, a big city is such a relative sort of term. And particularly today, I think the reason that these small cities are so prosperous and so attractive to people is that technology allows a small city to have many of the benefits of a much larger city. So that a city of 75,000 people, which, as I said, that was probably the size of Renaissance Florence, but it doesn't need to be backward anymore. It can have culture, it can have communications, it can have sophistication, it can have all the things which, in America at least, were traditionally associated with the really large cities.
So do you mean...
And only the large cities.
So do you mean, I'd get to kind of juxtapose something for a minute. This is really interesting. This whole idea that, I mean, if you look at cities in America, like, let's say, Fort Wayne, Indiana, or Lincoln, Nebraska, or Boise, Idaho, and think about then older cities like Baltimore, Detroit, Pittsburgh, and then the great mega metropolises like L.A., New York, and a few others. So they're all on very different trajectories, aren't they? I wonder what you think where all that takes us, those three kind of trajectories.
Well, cities historically have tended to get larger. So one thing is the small cities will get larger in time. The question is, will they grow into, what form will they take? Will they grow into what we think of as a large city, or will they develop in a different way? My guess is the latter, because, I mean, Philadelphia and Baltimore have the shape they do because of things like streetcars and later railroads.
Mm-hmm.
The new cities aren't growing with streetcars, so they're growing in different ways. Even if they get light rail eventually in many of them, it'll still be somewhat different than the streetcar. So the future of the small cities is in some ways just as kind of mysterious as the future of really big cities, because that isn't clear either, whether big cities will remain in the shape they have, or whether we will have certain sort of big international cities like New York and L.A., but do we really need the other big cities? Lewis Mumford, of course, would have said that these cities are much too big. The critique of cities that people like him made back in the early 1900s was that the industrial city was completely out of control. It was much too big, much too dense. So we sort of get nostalgic about Baltimore in 1900. But there may not necessarily be that much to be nostalgic about. These large industrial cities were really tough places to live in. And they weren't particularly historically, how should I put it, they were unusual historically. I mean, for hundreds of years, the only big city in Europe was London that reached 1 million people.
Mm-hmm.
No other city came close, and London was somewhat of an aberration, and it had to do with the empire and a number of other things that created this extremely large city by the standards of the day. But other cities were much smaller, and it was a long time before I think the idea was that a bigger city was a better city. Throughout most of the 20th century, that was true, and cities were very proud to be, you know, the largest city in North America or the largest city in the country or the state. I'm not sure that's true anymore, and it certainly wasn't true before. So size, I think, is a concept which isn't sort of an unalloyed good, and the fact that big cities might get smaller isn't necessarily a bad thing. It's the way in which they get smaller, of course, that's important.
And the way in which they get smaller these days, it seems, is that at least in the last 30 or 40, 50 years, is that the middle class, mostly white but not necessarily just white middle class, has fled to create the suburbs, and the cities have become places mired, many places, in large parts, on poverty and poor people, with this whole urbanization, young urban movement growing, but it's really a very small percentage of the people in those cities, as you've written.
That's correct, yes. I mean, you have to remember the, all those novels about, written when cities were growing. I'm thinking of people like Dickens. I mean, the city was the place that attracted ambition, and people with ambition were attracted to the city. If you, the other people stayed in the village or the small town and, you know, stayed farming, and their lives changed more slowly. But the really ambitious people made it to the city. And sometimes I think one of the things that happens today is that if the city no longer attracts those people, that changes the city too. So it's about, as you said, it's about people leaving the city, but it's also about the inability of a city to attract people. New York still has the ability to attract ambition, whether it's, you know, a person coming from India or the Caribbean. They come from all over the world, but it still seems to have that ability. And that keeps New York going. I mean, it certainly isn't the native population. Mm-hmm. It has a very large percentage of foreign-born people. And they, it's a kind of, it's as if you were priming the pump of the city continually. That's very important for a city. If it's to be the sort of place that we think of as being vital and active and so on.
So how do you think then the 21st century cities can creatively, intellectually, intelligently accommodate the growth of middle-class families and younger thinkers and stuff in a city? Is that possible, or is this all in vain?
A big question is whether Americans will change their minds about living in cities. Right now, we've changed our minds slightly, because if we're very young, we were attracted to cities, which was not necessarily the case, mm-hmm, 10, 50 years ago. And we're also attracted when we retire. Our kids grow up, and then we get tired of living in the suburbs, and the city becomes an attractive place again. What we haven't succeeded in doing is convincing ourselves that the cities could be a place where you could raise a family. And with the exception, really, of New York, which has families living in cities, none of the other downtown areas are able to do that. Philadelphia has 70,000 people, but very few children. They tend to be single, mm-hmm, people or retired people. So that's a big sort of cultural question. And part of the answer, I think, is going to be the green movement. Part of the answer will be very high gas prices. All of those things change the way we evaluate our options. And it could well be that with higher gas prices, which sooner or later will come back, I think, for at least a certain number of people, you know, commuting, spending all this money on a large freestanding house suddenly becomes less attractive. And the city becomes a more attractive place. Europeans, of course, do live in cities at much higher densities than we do, in terms of families and everyday life. But of course, it's a different culture, and so that's, for me, that's a big question: whether we're able to make that shift, or whether we decide that that's really attractive or not. Because it is a cultural question in the end.
It is. I'm going to ask that question about the cultural question in just a moment. In between that, let me just ask you then, if are there places that you study, think about, visit, analyze, that are really retooling urban neighborhoods in a way that make them those kind of places for families, for feeling safe and thriving? Or is this just a notion of dreamers and a few people who are younger who move into the cities? Are there any places where it's really going on?
Well, the downtowns, there are about half a dozen American downtowns that have attracted significant populations, which can then support amenities and stores and things like that. And that was more than we had 30 years ago. And remember, there is no tradition of living downtown in American cities. Traditionally, American cities, the downtowns were commercial.
Right.
I mean, with a few exceptions. So that has changed, but it's a very small change. I think, as you mentioned earlier, it's just a fraction of a percentage of the population that's affected. I think some observers of cities have sort of been much more positive about the trend towards moving to small cities. And that's certainly one answer. I think we sometimes sort of have an image of suburbs versus Manhattan, but that's really a false choice because very few American cities, except New York, have a Manhattan.
Right.
Most have much lower densities, and the small city certainly offers a kind of intermediate stage where you have a smaller number of people. Remember, one of the things that attracts people to the suburbs is scale. I mean, the suburbs are not like a big city. They're actually collections of small communities.
Mm-hmm.
And people like that, you know, where you get to know your neighbor and you get to know the person at the city hall, and when you feel somehow that you control things. In a big city, you don't. I mean, by definition, you're just a tiny, anonymous piece of it. And the politics is all happening behind closed doors. So the small city, I think, offers an interesting kind of option, which has that attraction of smaller scale, but which has also density and, mm-hmm. and numbers of people and amenities, which you simply can't get when you spread out.
And I was just, what you just said made so much sense. I never thought about it in those terms until you just said it, which was that, I mean, Baltimore, Philadelphia, and a number of cities, like I mentioned, Cleveland, lots of cities in America were places where neighborhoods existed, where there was some shopping and people lived in their homes. They took buses or transit somehow to the downtown to do their shopping and went back home where the schools were and everything else in their neighborhoods. And what we're trying to do, and perhaps what you were alluding to before, is that culturally, perhaps it's a very difficult task to do to change that mindset, which leads to the suburbs, to translate that into bringing people into a downtown, which is really just New York City. That is a very difficult task, isn't it?
Yes. I have heard Montreal, for instance, has tried to kind of recreate the neighborhood by decentralizing its government to some extent in having neighborhood-level governments which are in some ways tried to recreate that perhaps sort of pre-industrial sense where you had a neighborhood and you controlled things. There was a parish and there was a school and you related to that, not to the whole city. And so I don't know how successful it is. It was since I moved out of Montreal, but that's possibly one option, is to try to break down the scale. After all, if you have a government for 1 million people, that's like the government of a country, a small country. And so it's impossible to have a personal connection to that, something that big. Inevitably, it's anonymous. So breaking it down and creating some sort of neighborhood level jurisdiction that where you can just go there if you have a problem, and it's sort of like making little small towns within the big city. I mean, that's possibly one solution.
So do you think that the whole idea of continuing to study and think about urban planning is a waste of time?
No, I think cities are really interesting. I mean, I reread Jane Jacobs' book again when I was writing my book, and I mean, she's continually fascinated by this idea that she's writing mainly about New York City, but that you have this very large number of people, and that it's the decisions of many individuals in a city that finally make the city. It isn't about grand plans. It's really about all these individuals doing things, and that really is very interesting because it's in our system, in our political and economic system, it is very fragmented. And finally, if enough people decide they like, you know, Netflix, then Netflix becomes a success,
right.
or iPhones or whatever it is. And cities are very much like that. And the attempt to, and there have been many, to try to sort of centralize it and straighten it out and regularize the city, at least in America, have always failed in the long run. And Jane Jacobs is someone who feels they should have failed, that the city is much better when it's this kind of somewhat anarchistic place that responds to individuals making choices, and it's not all predictable and neat and kind of lined up. And of course, it's what makes cities attractive, too, the fact that they're not predictable and that you can find all sorts of niches in a city because it hasn't actually been planned except in a very rough way.
So I'm curious about just your own thinking at the moment. I mean, just about yeah. because you write a lot about what we did with these centralized projects we had in the past, the mega projects, and how they would help destroy cities. And you really do are, you are a believer in kind of neighborhood viability and rebuilding small commercial corridors and making things very livable. So talk a bit about that and how you see that coming and where do you see it really working?
Well, actually, I think there's really two. I shouldn't say options, but there's two ways in which it happens at the moment. And one way is actually the big scale way, where a developer with lots of money and patience and manpower and skills, you know, does a very big project and actually tries to change many things at once, so that you bring in retail and housing and commercial all at once, and you kind of jumpstart the process, rather than waiting. Mm-hmm. There's enough projects around the country, and developers have gotten bigger and more experienced and smarter about this. That you can see this as one sort of option, or one way in which it happens, and then the other way in which it happens is the piecemeal way, where I'm thinking of there are neighborhoods in downtown Philadelphia that were sort of all old industrial neighborhoods which were almost empty, and then a few people moved in, and on a very small scale sort of restoring houses, and then a couple of developers came in and did slightly bigger projects, and then there was enough people living there that some stores started moving in. And so that took much longer, and it wasn't the plan. Nobody had any plan that they were following, but it was a kind of piecemeal process that built on itself. And the first example works really well if you have a city with a very strong demand, like Washington or New York or San Francisco, where people really want to live there. And then a large project can succeed. Whereas the second one tends to be a process which happens where the demand is much weaker and nobody really is prepared to risk doing something huge. And so it has to grow in a very small way. But it takes longer, but it also can establish itself in the long run as well. And it kind of, people start doing things at slightly bigger scale. So it starts off with small projects and then slightly bigger projects. And then somebody gets more optimistic and, you know, buys a block and starts to fix things up on a larger scale. So those are the two processes I see today that seem to work. They're more driven by entrepreneurs and risk takers and the private market, but the public government has a role to play because certainly the public government can make these projects very difficult and expensive, or it can encourage them. And the planning is important at the point where the one I'm very strong on development. I think that mm-hmm. the private market is what has created American cities from the beginning. But the downside of private development is that it's very self-contained. The developer really cares, as he should, about his own project. He's not really thinking of the whole city or the next neighborhood over or how it affects the bigger picture. And so somebody does have to kind of put the pieces together or link them up when they need to be linked. And that is the city itself. So cities are not very good at developing, but they do have that responsibility, and they do have the tools to deal with things like transportation or infrastructural issues. And only the city, I think, can really deal with those effectively.
So I like the way you put that, the balance between the two and how these things could work. Let me finally ask you this thing. It's a little bit of a fantasy question, but let me ask you anyway. Since you've thought about these people a great deal, you wrote that incredible book about Frederick Law Olmsted, which I loved. This new book you write about Franklin Lloyd Wright and Lewis Mumford and Jane Jacobs. Supposing here in the 21st century you had them all in a room. Tell me about the conversation you think would ensue, what you think they'd think about where we are now and how you'd lead that discussion with them. I'm just curious.
What's strange is that in many ways they're all, of course, very influential and their ideas have borne fruit, but in some cases at least not in the way they expected. So I suppose Wright would not be enamored of suburbanization, even though it by and large followed what he thought would happen. The one who would probably be the most positive is probably Olmsted, because in the last decade or two, we've sort of started building urban parks again. They're not quite as big as his were, but they're usually on the water. They're often industrial areas that get converted or waterfront areas. But the sort of public spaces in the city, which kind of disappeared, but from 1900 to about 1980, parks were not something that cities created. It was considered a sort of, I think, almost old-fashioned. Whereas now every city has one or sometimes several new big parks, either being built or planned, and they're obviously different than what he designed. But the idea has come to life again, and I think that would have, I think, interested him. With Jane Jacobs, I thought what's so her influence is enormous. You can't underestimate her influence, for instance, on planners and on anybody who manages cities or deals with cities in any way has been influenced by her ideas. But what's happened is that they've almost gotten too successful, and the kind of urban vitality that she kind of taught Americans to appreciate, the same way that Julia Childs taught Americans how to eat. She taught Americans how to live in cities. But the problem is there just aren't enough cities like Greenwich Village to go around. And so the places that she really loved and sort of studied and wrote about have become very exclusive. You know, the Greenwich Village or Society Hill in Philadelphia or these attractive old neighborhoods have become very expensive attractive old neighborhoods, and most people can't even think of living there. They couldn't afford it. So I think that would have surprised her. I mean, both the success of it and yet the way it's gone in a kind of unpredictable direction. Although she was so smart, maybe she foresaw that too. I don't know.
Well, I think that the hope. The hope and the possibilities and also the dangers that we've created were kind of rounded up in that little group we just created. So, Vito Rybaczynski, this has been just fascinating talking to you. I really do appreciate you taking your time. I know how busy you are, and it's been an honor to have you on the air with us.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Take care.